Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up in a few minutes, Ron Smith has a report on efforts in eastern Kentucky to increase the honeybee population by using old coal mines. First, leadership races in the Kentucky General Assembly won't be decided until January, but the campaigning is already underway. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh says that's particularly the case among House Democrats.
Louisville Representative Larry Clark has served in the Kentucky House since 1984. He's been the chamber's number two man since 1993. But in this year's regular session, he and House Majority Whip Rob Wilkie found themselves at odds with other House leaders over casino gaming. Clark admits the division was damaging, but says it was Speaker Jody Richards' decision to isolate the two from the leadership team.
It hurt the whole chamber. When we function as a team, we all do a lot better, but that was the decision the Speaker made, and why he made it, I don't know, but I'll just do the best job I can do.
Louisville Representative Joni Jenkins agrees the rift hurt the House and says that's one reason she's challenging Clark for the Speaker pro tem's position.
Over my 14 years here, I've shown that I'm a person that can work toward compromise, and it looked like that was something that was needed within the leadership team, and I thought I could bring something like that to it.
Majority Caucus Chair Charlie Hoffman of Georgetown also faces a January challenge. And as Yogi Berra would say, it's deja vu all over again. His opponent is Nicholasville Representative Bob Dameron, whom Hoffman upset 2 years ago. Dameron's still smarting from the defeat.
It was tough, especially when I thought, I had the race won comfortably. But I've had a lot of encouragement from a lot of members. They liked what we were able to do and I was able to do when I was caucus chair. And I think they look forward to returning to some of that. And so I feel pretty confident about it.
But Representative Hoffman is feeling pretty confident, too.
I've had a lot of commitments from people saying that they would like to see me continue in my present position, and I intend to reach out to each and every member and ask them to support me. I feel confident that they'll give me every consideration because we have worked so hard.
House Majority Whip Rob Wilkie is retiring, but he's not going quietly. He recently lashed out at Speaker Richards over the leadership rift and called for change. At least four people are interested in Wilkie's post, including West Liberty Representative John Will Stacy, whom many consider the front runner.
You know, there's issues that come and go, but there's a lot of good people that serve here in the House. And if you don't let those issues become personal, then there's no reason that you can't get along and work together on the next issue.
Also in the race are Owensboro Representative Tommy Thompson, Covington Representative Arnold Simpson, and Lexington Representative Ruth Ann Palumbo.
I've been interested in that seat previous to this time.
Coyly watching it all from the sidelines and dropping hints he may soon enter the fray in some capacity is former Attorney General Greg Stumbo, who served 24 years in the House, 18 in leadership. He's back and champing the bit to return to leadership, including as Speaker.
It'd be a great honor to end up a political career as being chosen by your colleagues in this chamber to become Speaker.
However, Stumbo says he and Speaker Richards are friends, and it's doubtful he will challenge Richards next year. What about talk that Richards may seek one more term and then move on? Is it true, Mr. Speaker?
No. I don't have any idea what I'm going to do, except I'm running for re-election in January, and I think I have the votes to do it.
So far, Richards has no opposition. It's rare to see leadership races underway so early, but the special session on pension reform is providing candidates the perfect opportunity for some face-to-face campaigning. Come January, they'll find out if their efforts paid off. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
As in other states, Kentucky's honeybee population has been decimated by parasites. An ambitious project in eastern Kentucky aims to bring honeybees back to the area while boosting the local economy. But the plan has a few skeptics. Kentucky Public Radio's Ron Smith has the story.
You can't overestimate Tammy Horn's fascination with bees.
There's a magic in the order of a hive, and every single bee matters.
Dr. Horn says she was born to work with bees. She's authored one book on beekeeping and is working on another. But it's her work as a senior researcher at Eastern Kentucky University that really gets her excited.
What I want is a distribution center. I want a warehouse. I want 500 employees. I want five different varietals of honey being offered. I want basically an Appalachian version of the Sioux Bee Honey Association.
That would be industry giant Sioux Bee, the Iowa-based company with hundreds of producers which sells honey worldwide. Those are lofty goals, but reachable, insists Dr. Horn, director of the Lost Mountain Honey Project. The goal of the pilot program is to establish a honeybee infrastructure in eastern Kentucky. It starts with planting high nectar-producing trees like sourwood and black locust to attract bees, hopefully leading to honey production this year. In the long term, Horn sees a thriving bee industry, one that provides jobs to keep young people from leaving the mountains to find work. So if everything works out, the project would be good for people, good for nature, good for bees. But as promising as it sounds, this story has its sticky side.
I see the potential here for these former mine sites to be real centers of agriculture.
Listen closely for two all-important words.
Mine sites.
Mine sites, as in coal mine sites. Two coal companies, International Coal Group, or ICG, and to a lesser extent, James River Coal, are involved in the project. 30 hives are located at three former coal mine locations in Perry and Leslie counties owned by ICG. Those remote locations are thought to provide natural protection from pests and chemicals that plague larger beekeeping operations. But just the mention of coal company to some locals already upset because of controversial mining practices such as mountaintop removal can stir up a hornet's nest of resentment.
They're taking her objectivity, or whatever the word might be, and they're going to use her to promote their destruction, their further destruction of the mountains of eastern Kentucky.
62-year-old Carl Shoup of Benham in Harlan County has a deep distrust of coal companies that do surface mining, shearing off tons of soil to get to coal seams below. The activist gives them credit for getting involved in the honeybee project, but is troubled at the same time.
How many wild bees did this company destroy in the first place by taking down the mountain, and how many trees and how many streams they polluted and in the process of making this land available for the commercial beekeeping industry.
Shoup accuses the companies of being outsiders, interested only in getting coal out of the ground as quickly and cheaply as possible, leaving the area and its unique culture in shambles. Accusations like that put coal companies in an impossible position, says International Coal Group executive Don Gibson.
There's some groups out there, you know, they're going to be against what we do regardless of what we do.
Gibson, director of permitting and regulatory affairs at ICG Hazard, insists the company is a good steward of the land.
A lot of times the coal industry is portrayed as being heartless people that are from another part of the world that's just coming here to mine the coal and take away from the area.
Absolutely false, says Gibson, who adds that he, like Carl Shoup, is also a native of eastern Kentucky, and, he proudly says, a third-generation coal miner, raised just 7 miles from one of the project's beehive sites. Gibson says he's most proud that International Coal Group is constantly looking for ways to reclaim land, in this case, replanting former mine sites with those bee-friendly trees. Meanwhile, Tom Webster is watching to see what happens.
There is certainly a potential here. It would be very interesting to see how this plays out.
Webster is state specialist in apiculture. That's the science of honeybee raising at Kentucky State University. He won't get into finger-pointing, but thinks the coal company-beekeeper relationship in this project is close to a win-win, with the potential to produce timber, premium quality honey, and beeswax to make things like lotions and candles. While he thinks it's too soon to make any grand claims about what honeybees can do to revive eastern Kentucky communities, he does believe there's a future for developing a beekeeping industry in the area.
Bees do not need flat ground, unlike many crops and livestock and other activities that require flat ground. The bees can fly uphill, they can fly downhill. So they do quite well in a place like eastern Kentucky.
Professor Tammy Horn was convinced of that a long time ago. But her dream of changing lives based on bees must coexist with a lingering suspicion of coal company practices and motives. She says the hard-line attitudes have paralyzed progress in the mountains for too long.
And I'm not being caught in that paralysis, because it's in our best interest to look at how we can get a more diverse economy. How can we reclaim this land in a way that, you know, people can have other incomes besides just that provided by the coal mining industry?
Horn would like to think that the Lost Mountain Honey Project, powered by bees, will help do that. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Ron Smith.
With CD sales taking a nosedive in recent years, bands and the music industry as a whole have been relying more on touring to earn revenue and build careers. Some artists make up to 80% of their revenue through touring. The current spike in gas prices now threatens those returns. Elizabeth Kramer reports.
The Louisville bass band VHS Urbeta just finished a three-month cross-country tour. Band member Mark Palgi says the gas tank was the star.
We would not have believed it if 5 years ago you would have said that gas prices were like over $4 a gallon. I mean, I remember filling up our tank and being like, $60 to fill up a tank? Now it's $100. It's $100 every time we fill up. It's unbelievable.
Palgi is far from alone. Bands across the country are feeling the pinch. Palgi's band is signed to a recording label, but many without contracts have scrapped plans to tour or have limited touring to their home region. Recording labels basically loan money to musicians to get in front of audiences. They know more of their money is going to pay for gas, but they haven't found any new strategies to deal with high gas prices. That includes the ATO label, which handles David Gray and My Morning Jacket. Jonathan Ishak works for ATO. He says touring is essential and the price of gas is just another expense.
You have to evaluate how you're going to allocate your funding for the band. If you are providing tour support, then it's just money that you can't spend on, say, making whatever, a music video. You got to allocate that much more money to touring.
That idea is playing out with another ATO band, The Wigs, which played to a packed club in Lexington last week with the Louisville band Wax Fang. The Wigs has been traveling almost nonstop since last October. The band and its label have been more cautious in routing shows and clustering dates regionally. But the tour has not been cut back, says guitarist Parker Gisbert.
We released a record, and whether the gas prices are $5 or $1 a gallon, we got to be out there supporting the record and touring behind this album. You know, there's people in these cities who you want to play for.
2 years ago, Scott Carney founded Wax Fang, which doesn't have a contract and lacks the money a label can provide. Carney says this year it is mostly played in cities close to home with a few distant destinations, traveling in a gas-guzzling van.
So far this year we've been to, we went to South by Southwest again, which is all the way down in Austin, and we have been to Chicago a few times, we've been to New York, probably done about 10 to 15,000 miles.
The music industry's dilemmas have spurred talk of new business models that aren't based on CD sales. One that is getting some buzz is 360 deals. These are contracts where one company handles touring as well as music distribution, merchandise sales, and licensing revenue, among other facets of a band's career, for a cut of the artist's profits. But there's not much revenue for new artists who don't have a large fan base ready to shell out money for tickets and merchandise. In the clubs, bands are asking for larger guarantees, that upfront money the band will get no matter how many tickets a show sells. While that can help bands cover gas costs, it isn't a long-term strategy.
The only strategies are really to tighten your belt and, in some cases, limit the geography that you're going to tour if you can't afford it.
That's Gary Bongiovanni, editor-in-chief of the trade magazine Polestar.
Certainly, when they know that their expenses have gone up, they're more likely to ask for a higher guarantee. But it always has to be supported by the marketplace.
And the issue of affordability seems to have already hit audience members, who are not turning out at some of this year's largest concerts. Recent reports show that ticket sales for Bonnaroo were down this year, and tickets are selling slow for once-sure sellout artists like Bruce Springsteen and Nine Inch Nails. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
When we come back, Stephanie Sanders talks with the actress who brought to life the characters of Mary Poppins and Victor Victoria. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, I'll speak with Dr. Albert Moeller about his book on atheism. First, her voice may be etched into the collective memory of millions of people. Julie Andrews' career launched with the rocket success of Mary Poppins. She later became the voice and face that made The Sound of Music a classic. Most recently, her elegant and warm persona has become that of the Queen of Genovia in the Princess Diaries movies. About 10 years ago, surgery to her vocal cords damaged them permanently and left her unable to sing. But Julie Andrews has found a new voice in children's literature, and one of those books has been adapted into a stage performance called The Gift of Music. It will be performed for the first time with the Louisville Orchestra next month. Andrews spoke with Stephanie Sanders about her films, her books for children, and how she moved on from the loss of her singing voice.
What question are you asked the most by interviewers or fans who come up and want to talk to you?
Oh, my goodness me. It depends what age they are. if it's little children, it's, you know, can you really fly? And did you really slide down the banisters? And did you really go mattress surfing? but in the Princess Diaries. But in terms of sensible questions... Oh gosh, it could be anything. Mostly, what's your favorite song? Do you have a favorite role? Do you have a favorite leading man? And those are all exceedingly difficult questions to answer because, of course, the truthful answers are many. You know, many different favorite songs, loving a different role for different reasons, and so on.
Sure, a number of people around the building where I work wanted me to ask you what your favorite movie was that you were in, or what your favorite co-star was.
There you go.
And I thought, well, how can she pick?
This is a very foolish analogy, but I sometimes liken it to a number of delicious puppies in a basket. And if you were asked to name your favorite, you simply couldn't, because each one has a different character, a different personality, a different reason that you love him or her. And in the case of the movies, each one has offered something unique, a wonderful script or a beautiful location or a wonderful director or people to work with, or the role itself was so beautifully written. I mean, it could be any number of things, and each one is a learning experience, truthfully.
Do you feel like each of those characters, whether it be Mary Poppins or Maria or... Victor Victoria or the Queen of Genovia, do you feel like you learn something from those characters?
Undoubtedly you do. Always. You never stop, I don't think. I hope.
What do you take away from characters like that?
Well, mostly the work experience and how to do it and you know, what is it that, what serves the character best? How do you find ways to convey it so that it's clear that what kind of inner life does the character have? All of those lovely, exciting things that are such fun to probe and to find out.
Let's talk a little bit about your memoir, Home. It reveals some interesting things about your childhood that I think many people wouldn't expect. Mm-hmm. Why was it important for you to write that book? Why was it something that you wanted to do?
I had a very passionate publisher who for about 14 years pursued me and wouldn't let me off the hook, kept saying, you know, I'd really love to do this. And at one point I asked myself that very question, why would I publish? I could just write it for my grandchildren or great-grandchildren, which I certainly probably would want to do if they were the least bit interested, but why publish? And eventually... I was persuaded to do it because I read a book by the wonderful director Moss Hart. He wrote a phenomenal biography called Act One, which, in fact, taught me, when I read the book, a great deal about early Broadway history, of which I knew nothing in those, you know, of the years that he was working. I knew nothing about that. And I thought, if I could bring something to people that they knew not very much about, that being English vaudeville and what it was like in those days. You know, I was on the edge of vaudeville when it was really fading. Music hall was not in its grand and glorious days. It was pretty tacky. And but what it was like to be touring England and the end of the war and all of that, maybe people who are interested in theater and would like to know a little more would get some information out of that and some knowledge. And that was one of the reasons that I was persuaded to do it.
And what kind of response have you gotten from your fans about the book?
Oh, unbelievable. I mean, not just fans, but, I mean, you know, it was blessedly and happily wonderfully successful and made, you know, the number one on the Times bestseller list, and seems that everybody was interested and seemed to enjoy what it was I wished to convey.
Were you surprised?
Yes. I mean, happily surprised. Delighted.
I know a lot of people want to know about how your vocal cords are doing, if your singing voice is coming back or if you think it ever will.
No, I don't think it ever will. Alas, the kind of operation that I had doesn't allow for that. I have a few notes that I can play with, but I miss it very much. But the evening that I'll be hosting and narrating and presenting in Louisville will have an enormous amount of music and a lot of tales by me and certain introductions by me to the music that I think will feel musical. There'll be a lot of montage footage that people can enjoy, and wonderful singers with me who will be more than sufficient, I think, I hope.
Sure. I mean, how was that show crafted?
As briefly as I can make it, it was crafted, it was a book that I wrote with my daughter about music and the creative process, about a young musician in olden times. It's a fable. About a young musician who sets out to find his muse. He knows he has more in life to offer, and he wants to search for it and learn more. And the book was very successful and was packaged with a beautiful CD, which had music to accompany it, since the whole point of the book is that it's about music. The gentleman that wrote that music is a great friend of mine and a composer, arranger, conductor called Ian Fraser. Out of the book, there was the most enormous serendipity, and it was suggested that my daughter and I put it together as a small piece for children's theater. We're both passionate advocates of the arts and literacy, and this little piece seemed to serve both those ends. It was done as a small musical for children in Long Island at the Bay Street Theater in Sag Harbor. And from that, the what you will be seeing in Louisville was developed. And that was, it was suggested that it would be a phenomenal piece for symphony orchestra, because I would be able to narrate it and tell the tale. And since it's about music, it would be not unlike something like Peter and the Wolf or Carnival of the Animals or those kind of narrated musical pieces that make for a good second half of the evening. The big question is, what does one do in the first half of the evening if I'm presenting something like that? And so we decided on the theme, since the book is called Simeon's Gift, we decided on the theme of the gift of music. And in essence, we're presenting gifts old and new. And the first half of the evening is the music of Rodgers and Hammerstein, and as it basically relates to me and to my work over the years. And the second half of the evening is the new gift, which is Simeon's Gift.
And is this the first time it will be performed with an orchestra?
Yes, you will be our debut with a full symphony orchestra. Absolutely, you will be our debut evening, and we're thrilled that you've asked us there.
Have you been to Louisville before?
No, I'm looking forward to it.
So is it something that you would like to take to other cities?
Oh, absolutely. We have other venues this year that we will be playing. We'll be at the Hollywood Bowl for two performances after Louisville, and then we'll be in Atlanta and Philadelphia. And hopefully, if we're successful, this will be an evening that I could take anywhere and present, and people would enjoy the music.
I want to go back just for a moment to what happened with your vocal cords. What I'm wondering is, because I imagine that's something that you probably still are coming to terms with every day. and I'm wondering what advice you would have for somebody who something happens in their life, whether, you know, with you it was singing, but it could be anything, because there are infinite types of people in the world. But for somebody who is faced with a decision like that in their life, how it is that, I guess, what advice you would give to someone who has to accept something like that and move forward?
I think that for me, eventually I had to say there must be something that I... what am I meant to learn from all this? What is the plus, if there is any plus? Can I stand on my head and make this a positive learning experience rather than a disaster? And indeed, it was disastrous and very, very sad, and I miss it more than I can say, but I would never have developed my children's publishing imprint. I would never have written as many children's books and novels. I would never have finished my biography, probably, if I was still doing that particular day job, if you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is amazing. My lovely daughter, with whom I write many of my books, said to me one day, she said, "Mom, you do realize, don't you, that you've just found a different way of using your voice." And it was as if a light bulb went on, and she suddenly made me feel a great deal better. And it was a wonderful thing for her to have. It was a lovely gift that she gave me.
So, and that brings me to another thing I wanted to ask you about is, I guess, what is coming up for you? Do you have film roles that you still want to tackle?
Well, they do cross my desk from time to time, and I'm certainly contemplating some. I have other books that I'm writing, and I have a big anthology, a book that is coming out early next year, but which I'm working on at the moment, of anthology of poems and lullabies and songs for children, because mostly my publishing imprint is to do with children's books. And my daughter and I are working on that for Little Brown. There are other books that will be forthcoming, I hope and trust. So between the speaking engagements that I do and now this lovely evening that I hope will develop into something that I can do from time to time, my card's pretty full.
I mentioned earlier in our talk that I had kind of asked some people around the building about what they would want to talk to you about.
Right.
And aside from questions, I got a very strong sense from almost everyone in my building that everybody loves Julie Andrews, and they want to be your friend. They have a secret crush on you.
How flattering. That's absolutely wonderful.
I mean, but you must get that a lot. Does that ever get old for you, being adored by everyone?
I love meeting people, and people are so generous and so embracing, and it's a win-win situation all around, I hope. For me, it is wonderfully life-affirming and exciting, and I love what I do. And I I've been raised in the theater, as you know, for so many years, and so it's what I've come to learn to love to do. So it is very, very flattering.
Well, good luck with the show, The Gift of Music, and I hope you enjoy your trip to Louisville.
I think I will. I'm really looking forward to it, and I can't wait to hear all that glorious music and see your lovely city, and I'll be there soon.
Julie Andrews will perform The Gift of Music with the Louisville Orchestra on July 11th. There's more information at our website, WFPL.org. Coming up, I'll talk with Reverend Albert Moeller about his new book on atheism. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Robin Fisher talks with astronaut Janice Voss. First, the president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville has written a new book in response to what he calls a surge in the growth of atheism in the United States. Dr. Albert Moeller's book is called Ism, Atheism Remix, A Christian Confronts the New Atheists. He joined us by phone to talk about the publication. What prompted you to write this book at this particular point?
You know, the rise of the new atheists in terms of their publicity, the books they're writing, presence on the bestseller list, clearly presents a challenge. And I think it's time that that there be an intelligent Christian response. And this is not alone. There are several also who are beginning to speak back to the new atheists concerning what they're presenting to the public.
Who exactly are the new atheists, and how do they differ from, for lack of a better term, the old atheists?
Well, that's really a good question. You know, atheism is hardly a new idea, although it's interesting to note that the word atheist wasn't necessary in the English language until the 16th century. But what makes the atheists today different, these new atheists, different than, say, the Bertrand Russells and other famed atheists of the 20th century, is that there's a new assertiveness, and there's a new public they're trying to reach. You know, Bertrand Russell was really speaking to the college and university circuit. He was speaking to a readership that was accustomed to the secularized thought of the 20th century. The new atheists are really speaking to the general public, and they are addressing themselves with a new assertiveness, and they certainly have a better means of communication. They're far more adept at reaching the public than the atheists of the 20th century.
Are they converting people to their way of thinking?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. The Pew survey of America's religious landscape that came out earlier this year in part one indicated that there is a larger number of persons who are willing to say that they do not believe in God, or they are not sure, or they are the nones. That's the word, N-O-N-E-S, which they're the people that list none in terms of their religious preference. So we certainly are living in a more secularized era in which the new atheists have an opening to help convince people that none is an appropriate designation.
Is it Christians that are converting to atheism, or are these converts coming from other religions as well?
You know, right now it appears that most of these people are inactives. They're people that have no particular Christian commitment, no particular philosophical or worldview commitment. You know, the new atheists are really good at popularizing their ideas. You have Richard Dawkins, who has credibility in the scientific world, and so people who know him there recognize his name. He certainly, in his book, The God Delusion, has reached the public. You have Christopher Hitchens, a far more acerbic, caustic kind of literary figure. You have people here who are adept at speaking to the public and are really trying to establish a new credibility for atheism in the public square.
Now you say there's been a surge in the number of atheists. Is that a recent thing, or is that something that's happened since 9/11?
Oh, I think it's probably been building for the last two or three decades. You know, the secularization of American culture is something we can note. If you go back 30 or 40 years, most persons would have said, and indeed most still do say, that they believe in God and are Christians. But to an even greater extent, people would have said that because they would have thought it was the expectation of those who would be asking the question. The secularization of our culture has provided an opening for the new atheists.
I guess one would ask, you know, what's wrong with this, with atheists sharing their knowledge and experiences so openly?
Oh, they have an absolute right to do it. I will defend their right to do it. But if you are a Christian, certainly a Christian theologian, then you have a responsibility to respond to an idea that is presented certainly as powerfully and as cogently as this. So they certainly have a right to do it, and as much as I have a right to speak on behalf of Christianity, but that's why we have an exchange of ideas.
Your book is called Ism, A Christian Confronts the New Atheist. What kind of a response have you gotten from the atheist community about this writing?
Yeah, the full title is Atheism Remix, kind of indicating the new remixed, as it were, character of this atheism. I've had a good exchange with a good many of the people involved in the new atheism, and that's to their credit. They're ready to have a conversation. They're certainly, again, rather eager for it. That's why they're writing these books. On the other hand, they do not have a good many arguments other than what they have in their books. And so it's interesting that they kind of shot their full arsenal in these books. It'll be interesting to see what they come up with in kind of a next wave.
Dr. Moeller, thanks for joining us today.
Rick, it's always good to be with you.
Dr. Albert Moeller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville and author of the newly published Ism, Atheism Remix, A Christian Confronts the New Atheists. We are arranging an interview with someone from the atheist community for a future program. In the meantime, more information about this topic is available at our website, wfpl.org. When you think of the job of being an astronaut, you probably think of moon landings, big white suits, and spacewalks. Well, there is some of that and more. Robin Fisher spoke with astronaut Janice Voss about being an astronaut, working on the Space Shuttle Endeavour, and the launch of the Kepler mission scheduled for next year.
The first question that I have to ask is, what is the payload branch? I read your title, and it meant nothing to me.
One of the things that's really great about a facility like Space Station is it's an environment that's different. So you can make hypotheses about how things will respond when moved to this different environment and see if you really understand how they work. So we have a large number of experiments that are done on Space Station in life sciences, material science, all kinds of different areas. They all have to have procedures. They all have to have equipment designed. And the payloads branch reviews them to help make sure that they will be user-friendly and easy to operate in that environment.
So you essentially work with space stations.
I work with the space station people on that end to make sure that things work and use the facilities property on space station. And I work the other side as well. I work with ground researchers to help explain to them how the space station environment is different, both in a research way and in an operational way from the environments that they're used to and how they have to change their activities accordingly.
So this is all part of the large title that we hear as a public of being an astronaut.
Correct. Most of the time, we aren't doing what most of the people think of us doing, which is flying in space. The missions last on the space shuttle up to about 2 weeks, on the space station up to about 6 months. But we're years between flights. So most of the time, we're actually helping other flights get ready to fly. In this case, for example, with my job, I'm helping the experiments be ready so when the people get up there to run them, they'll run smoothly.
When did you know that you wanted to be an astronaut or go into the space field? Was it not until you got into college, or was that your goal when you went into college?
I first got interested in the space program in sixth grade. I was visiting my grandmother, who lived at the time in DuPont, Indiana, and we went to the Madison Public Library and checked out a bunch of books, one of which was the science fiction story, A Wrinkle in Time by Madeleine L'Engle. And I just got hooked. I thought science fiction was the best thing I'd ever read, and if there's anything like that going on the planet, I want to be a part of it. And that's how I got interested in the space program. And my parents say, after I started reading science fiction, that I never talked about being anything else but an astronaut.
And did anyone ever tell you can't do that because you're a girl?
In hindsight, I think it went the other way, that they thought it was not worth mentioning that I couldn't do it because it was so obvious that I couldn't in some circles. I mean, in the close circles, my parents absolutely said you can do anything you want. And I had lots of mentors in high school and in college that said, what a great goal, go for it. The people that were skeptical, I think, thought it was just not worth the trouble mentioning it to me.
I think that's interesting. I think that's something that we don't think about when we see women in, you know, quote, non-traditional fields, is a lot of times it's not that they were discouraged because the impression was they would never do it anyway.
I think that has to be the case, because I certainly don't remember anybody ever discouraging me, and yet I hear story after story of people who are my age that felt they had been discouraged.
During 2000, you spent 11 days aboard the Space Shuttle Endeavour, and I know you've had several times where you've gone up. Tell us about the shuttle's mission during that particular time, and then, you know, what is it like to be on the Space Shuttle?
That mission is one that I particularly enjoy talking about because it's a case where I think you can honestly say that the Space Shuttle was the most cost-effective way of completing this project, which was to make a three-dimensional map of the Earth's surface that we can use in all kinds of applications, like the obvious ones people can think of as simulators for training pilots to fly into airports that they can't physically visit before they have to fly into them. But there are all kinds of applications, like where you put cell phone towers that they're most efficient, what's the actual highest point in the area, and how high are the other peaks around it obscuring it, things like that. We had a trucking company call during the mission and ask how they could get that information, because the truckers are much more worried about altitude changes and distance, and if they have to divert around construction, they really want to know the altitude of the alternate path. So what we did in that 11 days is we had an inboard antenna that was in the shuttle payload bay, and we had an outboard antenna on a long boom out the side of the shuttle to give you two sources so you can make a three-dimensional map, just like you need two eyes. And in that period of time, we mapped all of the land surface from 63 degrees south latitude to 57 degrees north, which covers 95% of the area where people live. And that data is being used all over this planet. It's a very valuable mission.
How do you access that data? Let's say I own a trucking company, and I want to see those maps. Can I?
You can. It's available in a format called Digital Elevation Model, DEM data. So it's a bunch of numeric strings, and you have to know how to read the file. The Jet Propulsion Lab was the NASA facility running the mission, and you can go to their website and look for SRTM data. That's what the mission was called, the Shuttle Radar Topography Mission, and that will have contact information of where to go from there to get the data. It's now being passed out by a government organization. I don't recall what it's called.
And this is something that pretty much affects us sort of every day, those of us on the ground. You know, that map might be used for something else that's going to affect me today or tomorrow or somewhere down the road. And I think that is something that is missed in the connection between NASA and the average citizen. It's things that affect all of us.
That's true. And if you actually challenge people a bit and say, weather satellites are run by the space program, and you can start going down the list, and they recognize that they just didn't appreciate that. They in fact know that it affects everything in their lives, but they just never thought of it as space technology, which in some ways is a good thing. It means that space has become such an automatic part of their sense of what ought to be in the world, mm-hmm. that A, they don't really notice it when it's there, and B, they aren't surprised to discover it's everywhere.
Until November of 2007, you were the science director for the Kepler mission. Tell us about the Kepler mission, because it sounded fascinating what I read about it before the interview.
I agree. It's a completely fascinating project. I feel very privileged to have been a part of it. It's a spacecraft that's supposed to launch at this point February 16th of 2009, so we're very close to launch. It's going to look for extrasolar planets, which, of course, lots of people are looking for, but what's special about Kepler is it can find planets that are Earth-like, which means not only the right size, but also the right distance from their parent star to potentially have life just like us. The surface temperature should average that of liquid water. Most of the planets we've found so far are either way too big or the temperature's wrong. So I'm really excited that the design, given what we currently know about planetary systems, says it will probably find, during the four-year course of the Kepler mission, about 50 planets that could potentially be just like Earth. And it's not really about going to visit those planets, because they'll be very, very far away. They're like 500 light years away, which is a long ways. But what it does is it helps us understand what planetary systems are all about. So if we discover that Earth-like planets are everywhere, there's a good chance if we go to visit some of the nearby stars that we'll find them.
With the Kepler mission, how long does it take that data to get back to us here on Earth?
So the data comes back very quickly. The spacecraft is what we call Earth trailing, which means it's in Earth's orbit about the sun and it follows the Earth. So we can send data directly from the spacecraft to the Earth. It comes down about once a month and gets processed. But in order to find Earth-like planets, you want an orbit, of course, that's roughly a year. For smaller stars, the orbit's a little bit quicker, and for larger stars, the orbit's a little bit larger. But our target is a sun-like star with an Earth-like orbit, which means the orbit is a year. And the process that we use, which requires looking for repetitive patterns, means you have to have at least three measurements before you can find the Earth. And you really need four to be sure that you've really found it and it's just not another physical phenomenon that looks like an Earth. So if you need four data points and it's a one-year orbit, you need 4 years to find the planet, a minimum of three, because if you happen to catch it just as soon as you launch, you get one data measurement. You could do it in 3 years, but you'll probably need more than that. So it's really going to be 4 years after it launches before we have data on the right planets. We'll have data we can publish inside of the first month of the planets that are very close to their stars. But for the planets that we really want, it'll be 4 years.
And has this mission already been funded?
It has. It's fully funded. The spacecraft is well through its testing phase and doing well. So there's no reason that it shouldn't launch on time at this point.
Every job has sort of its day-to-day tedium. But, you know, then there are days when you're like, oh, right, this is a great job. Do you still have the wow factor
in
being an astronaut?
In fact, what I was doing this morning was talking to one of our suppliers, Hexion Specialty Chemicals, right here in Louisville, Kentucky. And they provide some phenolic resins that are used to construct the nozzles on the end of our solid rocket motors that help us launch the space shuttle. And when I got up this morning, I was thinking, it's going to be so much fun to talk to these people because they're going to be so excited, and I'm going to have so much fun sharing with them all the experience of being in space and all of the efforts that they're expending, how it's paying off and doing really great things for this country. I had a wonderful time this morning. And because I get to almost re-experience from scratch, because these are people who haven't had a lot of contact with my world, and explaining it to them and seeing their reaction makes my world fresh and new again. I have these kinds of experience once a week in my job still.
And what would you like everybody to know about what's going on at NASA?
There's a couple of different areas depending on where your interests lie. One would be that it's a marvelous way to inspire kids to math and science. The things that we do are so fascinating and interesting, even to children, that it's a great way of keeping the technology developing in this country. That's one. The second is that we're doing really interesting research that's paying off in areas of life science and material science, much very effective way of using our money to return knowledge back to the people of the planet. And the third is that it's a wonderful way of interacting with international players and keeping this world kind of in harmony and all the countries talking to each other. We just landed a mission last week that had the Japanese experiment module delivered on it. So we had the first time the Japanese full players in the space station. We had the European module came up in January. Of course, the Russians have been on for some time, and the Canadians have the robot arm. Those are the major players, but we have a lot of other countries that have lesser players, but we've got all these countries now working together in a peaceful, high-tech environment, which is a really marvelous way of engaging everybody with the American people.
It's truly an international space station.
Absolutely.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with astronaut Janice Voss about what it's like to be an astronaut today. Voss joined Robin prior to her visit to the Center for Free Inquiry at Hanover College's Crow Academy. For more information, visit our website, WFPL.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.